Good morning and welcome to what I think is going to be a specially raucous edition of All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy, and today we're going to talk about books with three of my favorite people and three of the area's most literary leading lights. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. Bill Eichenberger is a book critic and a blogger at thebooksurf.blogspot.com. And Kevin Griffith is the adult of the group. He is a professor of English at Capital University and a poet, and he recommends thepoetryfoundation.org. We're going to invite your phone calls, your comments, and what you've been reading and what you may suggest for us all to read. But as usual, my panel has come in with a stack of books. And the reason I was late getting into the studio today is that I was reading and engrossed in Bill Eichenberger and Cassie Rose's blogs, which are addictive. And I have two words to throw out there to our panel. We'll start with Cassie. Hans Falada. Who is Hans Falada?
Oh, Hans Falada was a very famous and popular German novelist between World War I and World War II. And then Hitler came on the scene and tried to influence his work during the war with censorship and tried to get him to write propaganda, and he didn't want to. He also struggled mightily with addiction and psychological problems, and actually during the World War II was in and out of the asylum. The reason that he came into my life this past week is
Cassie. Okay.
Well, he is through advertising that I saw for some of his books in the London Review of Books that have been reissued. But most specifically, Every Man Dies Alone, which has a tremendous story behind it. Hans Falada was handed a Gestapo file in 1956 by someone who said, "This is the stuff that great novels are written from." And he proceeded to write a book based on this file in 24 days in a white heat, an obsessive white heat. And the story, the true story, which he has fictionalized, is about a couple in Berlin during the war and Nazism who were apolitical until their son was killed on the front, their only son. And they therefore turned against the Nazis and in Berlin started to circulate postcards that were resisting Nazism and Hitler. Well, it was so widespread and successful that the Gestapo thought that there was a huge organization behind this couple, and they did work very hard to find them, did find them, and arrested, tried, and beheaded them. So Hans Falada took their story and wrote it in this book called Every Man Dies Alone, which never got translated into English until last year, April 2009, by Melville House Publishing. And it's coming out in paperback end of this month.
So years after Mr. Falada's death, this book is finally available in English. Mm-hmm. And you, on your blog, and I read some other pieces about this book online, everybody's saying the same thing. You cannot miss this novel. Why?
Yes, it's gripping from what they say. Liesl Schillinger reviewed it in the New York Times and on the Charlie Rose Show, which there is a 15-minute segment with Falada's son on it and the publisher and Schillinger. We're just saying that you can't – it's just gripping because of how he, I don't know, constructs their life. I don't know yet why, because I haven't read it,
okay.
But it is on – because I just discovered it this
past
weekend.
But the buzz – that seems like a bad word in this context, but the buzz is pretty intense about this novel.
It is. And Alan First blurbs the book and says – and Alan First is one of my favorite espionage writers for World War II, and I know Bill is a big fan. And he said, "Do not miss this book."
Every Man Dies Alone by Hans Falada. That's F like Frank, A-L-L-A-D-A. And Kevin Griffith, you also, your eyes lit up when we were talking about him before the show began.
I was sort of turned on to this book about a year ago. And it's been out in hardcover mm-hmm. for about a year. And I actually had it in my hands and I was going to read it, but it's very long.
Yes, it is.
And I never got around to reading it. And the reason my eyes lit up is I'm so glad Cassie's on this show because she reminded me that that has to get on my book of and my list of books to read mm-hmm. here soon, because that was a really intriguing concept. And apparently the reviews of it say, yeah, it reads just like a great suspense novel. Mm-hmm. It's a very quick read and just devastating.
And I would recommend taking the 15 minutes to listen to this Charlie Rose segment, and there is a link on the blog to it, as well as to an LA Times article about the book and also Falada and his story of He had some pretty difficult psychological struggles, starting from when he was a kid, and he got into a duel with a friend of his and shot his friend.
It was a half joke, and they both thought they were suicidal as teenagers. It's a terrible story.
It is.
And they were half kidding in this duel, but he killed his friend in the duel when he was about 13 years old.
And then he went into the asylum after that. I mean, they called him an asylum back then.
Okay, it's a pretty day outside. It's spring. We're dragging. It's 10 minutes into the show, and we're already suicidal. Let's get over that. We're going to elevate the tone and get happy. So I'm going to have Bill Eichenberger give us some happy talk right now.
Oh, really?
Oh, he's looking at the deck of books. Saying, are you kidding me?
Library of America is finishing its complete works of Mark Twain, which it began back in the early 1980s. And they finished it with a very interesting anthology, and it's been put together by Shelley Fisher Fishkin, and you'd be familiar with her if you saw Ken Burns's documentary on Mark Twain. She's one of the leading Twain scholars, and it is a collection of writers mostly, but also journalists, critics, and even just sort of celebrities who have written about what Mark Twain meant to them. And the interesting thing, a lot of people, you know, obviously Hemingway had said that the, you know, all of American literature is based on one book, and it's called Huckleberry Finn and things like that. T.S. Eliot said that, you know, that there's once in a generation you have a unique writer who creates a whole new way of writing, but that other people, lesser people, can use and write in that same vein. And he put Twain in that. But what Fishkin has done is collect at least a dozen previously not unpublished but untranslated into English, pieces from writers from China, from Argentina. And it's really interesting to see what a wide influence Twain had across the globe and across the century. She talks about that's the other thing she talks about. It's pretty much in chronological order, and you'll have the critics sort of talking about Huck Finn. And then she says, and then in the early 90s, the hero of the novel suddenly changed, and for the last 20 years, it's been Jim. And so that's where the interest is. So each generation has reinterpreted Twain, has chosen its hero of the book, and just really an interesting collection.
Well, let me ask Professor Griffith, is Huck Finn the seminal American novel?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I think
look at
even,
him. Why, he looked right at me like I'm going to be nuts.
No,
yes.
A lot of people even argue that, you know, of all the influences in T.S. Eliot's poem, Masterpiece, The Wasteland,
yeah.
All the various things he cited, you know, Dante, everything else there, all the mythology, that really he was inspired by Huck Finn. Huck Finn drove the wasteland. Just the narrative style, you know, the flow of that novel, that's why. What's also interesting about Huckleberry Finn, I was reading Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac, and how terrible the reviews of that were when it first came out.
I'm sure he got very condescending notices for that when that was first.
Yes, and many of the reviewers said, you know, no child should ever be allowed to read this. It's so demoralizing and dark and contains nothing uplifting whatsoever, and just really bizarre interviews.
Is it considered the definitive novel based on its structure and flow and rhythm or because of the plot? I mean, why? Why is it the one that has been chosen?
You look unconvinced, Cassie Rose.
I am.
Okay.
I am.
If you look at Nathaniel Hawthorne and The Scarlet Letter, that's a book that really could have been written by an Englishman who just happened to live in America. Mm-hmm. And you could never say that of Twain. It's in the vernacular. It's American types. It's in a way that really had – I mean, Melville, you could argue, is a very American writer in his way. But I don't think that anybody – and nobody talked about race. First of all, no one had – exactly the same kind of race situation that we had, and so therefore nobody talked about race in such a profound way as a subtext as that Twain did. And so, and then I think based on his influence, all the writers who came after him, Faulkner who wrote completely differently than Hemingway, still said he was the light, you know, the lighthouse for everybody else. So even two writers who were at such extremes in style as Faulkner and Hemingway both poignant to Hemingway is, or I mean, to Twain, and especially to Huckleberry Finn, is that book. That,
so it's everything that came together then during that time. It's like what he was doing, how he and his reputation at the time, all those small elements coming together then created that.
What I remember about reading Huck Finn is you can hear their voices. It's completely mm-hmm. authentic, and I think that ties in with what you were saying, Bill.
Right.
It's completely authentic in a way that very mm-hmm. few novels that I've experienced have been.
Did you read it as an adult?
I did not. I read it in high school. I'm not an adult now, and I'm going to have to go back 35 years later and see what the story is there. But you have each, as usual, thank goodness, brought a stack of books with you. So let's start with Cassie Rose. What have you brought for us to talk about and recommend?
I think I'm going to start with The Girl Who Fell from the Sky by Heidi Durrow. It's her first novel. And I was taken by this book because of her technique of the voices. She goes in and out of different viewpoints. And I don't think every author succeeds with that technique because it's not always sure that they will differentiate the voices or that they won't, you know, you won't feel fragmented with the drama. And she succeeds from a child's voice to an adult's voice. And it's a family tragedy. And it's the tragedy is that a mother and her children fall from or jump from or are pushed from a rooftop. You don't know what it is. And that's the mystery. And everyone dies except the older girl. She's about 11. Her name is Rachel. And so her voice is the prominent one, but we also hear from her father and her mother. So there's a lot of back and forth in time. And it's to understand what is it that happened on that day. The other compelling part of this novel is the issue of biracial identity, because Rachel, the girl, is the daughter of an African-American GI who was based in Germany, and her mother was a Danish woman. It takes place in the 1980s. And in Europe, there were no problems with interracial marriage or biracial identity, but in America, there still were. And so that works out and plays out in the book. And it's very, very easy to get lost in the emotions of the book and this issue and what happens to Rachel and how everybody interprets her situation and the mystery.
Is a mark of a book like this that it be, is a success when you have a tragedy that you are ultimately uplifted when you're reading it, or does that matter?
I think it does matter.
Does it happen here?
I don't know that uplifted is the right word, okay, as much as though you get greater understanding, you have greater compassion, you walk away having learned something maybe you wouldn't have thought of. I think those are the better books because you continue to think about the book afterwards as opposed to, oh, my gosh, I just had an experience. Wasn't that a dark one? And then, you know, forget about it. This does lift up because, again, it takes you back. It was just, 20 years ago. It wasn't that long ago that there were these kinds of issues, which surprised me, you know, some of the reactions of people and the prejudices. I was startled by it.
Give me the title and the author again.
It's called The Girl Who Fell from the Sky by Heidi Durrow.
And this is her first novel.
It is her first novel.
I'm Christopher Purdy. Today we're talking about books here on All Sides Weekend with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. We're going to invite your calls at 292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. The number again, 292-8513. That's a 614 number. Let us know what you're reading. Let us know questions about books that you liked or didn't like. We'd like to hear from you. We're going to take a one-minute break right now as you get ready to go by your phone. We'll be back shortly here on All Sides Weekend /books.
On your drive home, get local updates with the award-winning WOSU News Team.
The January earthquake in Haiti could leave up to 150,000 amputees. To help, Hanger Prosthetics and Orthotics is collecting artificial limbs patients no longer use.
We can get these people back on their feet again because we're training technicians. We're training patients to be practitioners.
Hear the latest in local and national news with All Things Considered on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And good morning. You're listening to All Sides Weekend on WOSU 820 NPR News. 54 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20. Sunshine today, a high of 65 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 43. Some sunshine for Saturday and a few clouds in the afternoon, a high of 65. And then some rain moves into the area early Sunday morning. All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I think it's a mark of a great panel that we get so caught up in our conversations off mic that Amy Jurevich, our producer, is waving through the glass. Put on your headphones and get back on the air, for goodness sake. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend / Books, and I do hope that the listeners are having as much fun as we do here in this studio, if I may say, with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. Kevin, give me a recommendation.
Okay, I have a really good recommendation. We talked about something perhaps light for spring.
Yes.
This is light, but deeply cynical as well, but very, very funny.
It's a
brand new novel, just came out, called The Ask, A-S-K, by Sam Lipsight. And this is a satirical novel about college fundraising, of all things. The protagonist is Milo Burke, and he works for a university. You're going to love this. This is the name of the university he works for, the Mediocre University of New York City.
No.
And it's just like every
single... How do you do that and not get people to take it seriously, or is it not meant to be taken seriously?
I think it's so over the top,
okay.
You know, it's borderline. It's sort of... If Kafka met Jerry Seinfeld or something, it's a very funny novel. And his problem is that he gets fired, but they'll allow him to come back if he can get the big ask, the guy who's going to give him all the money to start this art center. And he finds out that the guy he has to ask is an old college roommate whom he hated. And so he has to go and, you know, wine and dine him. And then as part of that, he has to locate this donor had an illegitimate son, so he has to go out and deal with this illegitimate son and the problems that raised. And it's just very, very funny. One of the really funny things, the character names are hilarious, and each has a little story behind it. I think I can say this on the radio, but his boss's first name is Vargina, because when he was born, when she was born, her mother didn't know what to name her, so just named her the first thing that came to her mind. But the nurse inserted an R in it so she wouldn't be embarrassed for the rest of her life.
Professor Kevin Griffin, professor of English at Capital University.
I just thought that was very funny.
I do indeed.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's just a great novel. It's called The Ask, A-S-K, by Sam Lipsight. It just came out from Knopf, and I had a great time reading it.
Cynicism in a novel can be a lot of fun, but I think it would be difficult to not turn people off. I think the balance would probably be so. Clearly, he's got the balance right. So
I would think so. Although, you know, if you do like uplifting endings, I wouldn't read it. Or if you want something that you know raises your spirits, I wouldn't read it in that way. But if you want to laugh a lot and laugh at the foibles of society, pick it up.
It sounds good to me. We have a caller on the line. We have Scott with a recommended book. Hello, Scott. Are you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I did pick up on the panel suggestion a few months ago, Middlesex, and read that. So I want to thank the panel for that. I mostly like the immigrant story more than the issues with sexual identity, but I thought it was a great read. The book I'm reading now that I'm almost done with it, I think is terrific, is a German book. I think his name is Hans Falada.
We just talked about it, right?
Oh,
yes.
You?
No. Please, let's have your view of that. Please, go ahead.
It's really it's not light. I wouldn't say that, but it reads pretty quickly, and just a great story about the maybe the futility of the German resistance movement, but an interesting book to read.
You're talking about Every Man Dies Alone, is that right?
I am.
Yes, yes. And you're recommending it?
I am. I think it's almost done, and I'll finish it tonight, and it's really a pleasure.
Scott, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Back comments. So listen, people haven't even – they tuned in late and we're loving Hans Falada, which
yes,
I think is great, because we spent the first 10 minutes talking about that.
One of the things I want to check, and I would also recommend to listeners, is that Philip Kerr, an English writer, has written a series of books featuring a German private investigator named Bernie Gunther. And they're set in the 1930s and during World War II. And he's a PI who searches for a Jewish person who's disappeared. or things like that, or he gets caught up in the web of sort of Nazi duplicity and that kind of thing. But they're interesting. But I'm wondering if he's weighed in on the Falada. I bet he loves it as well because it's the same mm-hmm. era that he writes about and actually the same genre, really. So
yeah, I don't know.
And our producer, Amy Jurevich, says, don't give me a heart attack. I'm on vacation after today. No, take it easy on me with the pronunciation. So well, that's very good. We've had a call from a listener, Ellen, who called in and recommended The Kabul Beauty School by Deborah Rodriguez. Does anyone know about that book?
Yes, Bill? I've heard about it. All I know is that it's about a woman who goes to Kabul and literally starts a beauty school. And it's kind of a feminist novel about the empowerment of Afghani women after the Taliban. If I'm wrong about that, please call in. But that's my recollection of.
Very good. And we have Scott on the line. Scott, are you there?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I read a reviewer had in passing mentioned that the funniest book she had ever read was something called by the poet Randall Jarrell, who died back in the 60s, and it was called Pictures from an Exhibition. And it sounds like the humorous novel was already recommended. It was about a college professor.
Yeah, Randall Jarrell's absolutely. That's a hilarious book.
Oh, okay. That's what I wanted to know, if it could be recommended by you all.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Talk about that a little bit, the Randall Jarrell novel. Is it that funny?
Yes, it's
okay.
Very good.
What's funny about it?
Oh, not Christopher. I knew you were going to do that. I read it so long ago.
Okay. Well, if you recommend it, then that's – I always take your recommendations.
It's out of the cobwebs of my mind.
And I'm never disappointed by any recommendations.
Randall
Jarrell.
Also,
I want to make the point, too, that each of our panelists have blogs and have outlets for their work in writing. And if you go to wosu.org/allsides, they're all linked there. So you can go there rather than shopping around. wosu.org/allsides. Bill Eichenberger brings older books with him, and he brings books that are pretty to look at as well as pretty to read. So what else you've got in your list for us?
Well, I have a favor I want to ask anyone out listening today, and that's I just finished the first novel in the Stephen R. Donaldson trilogy, Lord Falsbane. It's the chronicle of Thomas Covenant Unbeliever. And I got through it. But I've got two more to go, and well, more now that he's written more, probably five more to go if I read through the whole thing. And I'm just not convinced I should go on through. There have just been some hang-ups I've had with the book that we talked about books when you decide not to finish them. Well, I finished this one, but I'm not sure I can go through the whole series. So if there's anyone out there who just loves this book and can tell me why I should go on, I'd appreciate the input because I'm really up in the air right now about whether or not to continue.
614-292-8513 is the number to call right now. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Let's throw a line to Bill Eichenberger, who doesn't know whether he's going to finish. Is it a series of five books?
Well, the first were three. He resisted writing the follow-up to it for years, and then his publisher finally convinced him. He wrote three more, and now there's two, I think, since then. So this is over a course of 30 years.
What hung you up a little bit, or what's hanging you up, do you think?
The language is very peculiar.
Okay.
The main character, Thomas Covenant, uses very bizarre – he uses the word hellfire all the time. That's his kind of expletive.
With explanation points too, probably. Yes.
And it's just – who says that? It's just bizarre. And then Donaldson uses really peculiar words and unusual words. And a lot of sometimes it's the right word, but then other times he gets a pet word like incarnadine or something, and he just uses it over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so the language keeps – I keep bumping up against it, and then I'm not sure, and maybe this will maybe it unfolds over the course of the next two novels, but the whole premise is that he's a leper, but he goes into a coma, and when he goes into a coma, he enters this place called the land, and he's not sure whether he's dreaming when he's in the land or if the land actually exists. But one of the other things, too, is that characters begin to die, and you realize he doesn't draw very convincing characters, so you don't care when they die. They're just names now dying, and
would turn me off a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what? Ask and you shall receive. We have Ed calling in with a comment about The Covenant. Ed, are you there?
Yes.
Go
ahead. I read that years ago. I read the first three, and I thought they went very far downhill after the first one, and he gets extremely repetitive, and you get extremely irritated with the title character. It's like, come on, you know, make up your mind kind of thing.
Right.
The end of the third novel has a good payoff, but by the time you get there, it's like, God, I'm glad that's over.
Yeah, that's interesting, and that's interesting, too, because I became very frustrated with the main character. I mean, the choices he's faced with, and, you know, he just keeps, you know, I mean, he is called the unbeliever, but you still want him to say, you know, forget, you know, make up your mind.
Yes, it's like doing, it's the definition of insanity is kind of what he's going through, making the same choice over and over again.
Exactly.
Well, can you read one of these books and not read the others and get anything out of it? Or do you are you sort of compelled to read the entire series?
I don't think you're compelled to read the entire series, and I did not read the last three. I think if you read the first one, okay, you're pretty good. The second and third one get even bleaker, anything. And I would say the first one was a good enough read standalone if you like that kind of thing, which I generally do, but that was just an infuriating book to read.
Right.
We're talking about The Covenant. Is that the name? The name?
The Covenant book, Lord Foul's Bane, which was the first one of the first trilogy. Yeah.
Thank you, Ed, for your call. Who's the author again?
It's Stephen R. Donaldson.
And that's you said really it was helpful. Written over 30 years.
All three of these were written in the 70s, and they came out in consecutive years in 77, 78, and 79. And then he wrote another trilogy set in the land like 10, 12 years later.
He's like Wagner. He doesn't know from brevity. Get off already. And, you know, we have another caller from the Save Bill Eichenberger Society. David is on the line. David wants to talk about The Covenant as well. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. I actually want to agree with the last caller, except and they do get progressively worse.
That's interesting.
Lord.
And I love that sort of stuff.
I mean, I do too.
I enjoyed the first book. And then the second book, you know, started to bug me. And the third book, I despise.
Well, okay then.
I'm so glad I asked.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you, David, for your call. We all, changing the subject a little, we have an email from a listener who recommends A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth, which I liked very much. I thought that was a beautiful novel. Anybody read that or
no.
Any recommendation? That I'd warmly recommend it. It's a fairly recent novel. It's rather long. It doesn't read long. It's about the life of an Indian boy and everything that he has to deal with, and there's all kinds of family issues, and he becomes the caregiver for an elderly grandfather, and it's quite a beautiful book. Well recommended, Vikram Seth. Okay, back to you, Kevin Griffith, what do you have for us? From cynicism and academia, can you imagine, to what?
I'll try not to make any more unfortunate pronunciations either. But on the last radio show, Cassie and I were talking about poetry. And where do you find good, readable poets? And Philip Larkin's quote came to mind. Philip Larkin's one of my favorite poets, but when he edited a literary magazine, it said he had two rubber stamps that he would put on poems that came into the literary magazine. One said, "What does this mean?" And the other one said, "Why should I care?" And I think a lot of contemporary poetry doesn't pass to the Philip Larkin stamp test. But one that does, and Cassie and I both brought it in, is a poet. He's an Ohio poet. He's up at John Carroll. His name is George Bill Gare, and we don't have his most recent book is called The White Museum, but we both have a book that was published a couple years ago called Haywire, and he really writes about real human understandings, the past. Let me just read a bit.
Please
from
do.
One.
Yes.
This is a good representative poem. It's called Good Humor. You don't often hear them anymore, but now and then a survivor of the great ice cream truck purges at the end of the last century approaches with its sad little tune from a far street on the last page of the Book of Summer. And even now this urge arises, this panic to run inside the house that is still there, to find the mother who is still sitting at her Singer sewing machine making a cotton shift for my sister who is still in second grade, and ask her, beg her for the nickel that will buy the popsicle or drumstick or orange 55 bar from the foggy cave of the truck, whose music may be drawing closer now or moving farther away. At this distance, it's hard to say.
Wow.
And, you know, the great, great poems always risk sentimentality without being sentimental, and he's very good at doing that.
Yeah.
The first line, he says, that sad music, and it's like you wouldn't think of that as sad music, and yet when you really think about it, it is sad music.
it is.
We have Chris calling in who wants to talk about Hemingway. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I've been recently reading a lot of classics, and I just finished To Have and Have Not by Ernest Hemingway, and my question to your guest is, does he completely have no concept of womanhood or of women, or were the women just completely bonkers in the 30s?
No, you're right. He has no concept. If you want to know what a woman was thinking or what women thought in the 30s, read Jean Rhys. R-H-Y-S. She wrote The Wide Sargasso Sea, but she wrote what's called the Paris Quartet, and they're absolutely – and you won't even recognize her Paris when you compare it to Hemingway's In a Movable Feast. Just absolutely stunning.
Interesting. I mean, and I love Hemingway. Don't get
yeah,
me wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other comment I wanted to make is that I just finished Upton Sinclair's The Jungle.
Oh.
That completely blew me away. I remember learning about it in school and being like, oh, you know, that's about something back in the past. But it really resonated with me just in our current situation.
I unpacked my books from my library after they were in hibernation for 3 years. And that's one I set aside. That's one I'm going to read. So I can't wait.
Especially for the immigrant story. I mean, it's a little heavy on the communist stuff, which I think is okay. Some readers might be turned off. But if anyone that's moved to this country from another country, I think it would really, really resonate with them.
Mm-hmm. I could also recommend Upton Sinclair's Boston, which is about Sacco and Vanzetti, which is an incredible, harrowing read there. Our number is 292-8513. That's a 614 area code. You can also send email to allsides@wosu.org. We are talking about books on today's edition of All Sides Weekend with Cassie Rose, Bill Eichenberger, and Kevin Griffith. Cassie, let's go back to you. What else do you have for us today to talk about or recommend?
Well, I want to tag on to what Kevin was talking about with the poetry book Haywire, because the last show I had written a rant on my blog and we had talked here about I just was tired of spending money for poetry books that I would get 10 poems in and would just hate them. And I didn't know how to find good poetry. So Kevin sent me the email and recommended Haywire, and he was right on the money. It is. And then I thought, well, what is it about poetry books that I want, that I look for? Because I had a double bonus these past couple weeks, because I also found Christopher Reed's A Scattering, which is a book of poetry that won the Costa Book of the Year Award in the UK, which not a book of poetry, but book of the year. And it hadn't sold more than 1,000 copies. And in this book, you get the same. It's not too sentimental. And he creates scenes which about him and his wife, because it's a tribute to the death of his – well, it's a tribute to his wife who died in October of 2005. And in the very beginning, he writes poems about their vacation in Crete and how she is gathering flowers with her field guide. And then the last three sequences are about his memories of her and his grieving of her. But again, it's not too sentimental. And there's one poem where he writes about being in bed, going to bed one night and thinking, oh, you know, I got home sooner than she did. And he gets into bed and then he thinks, oh, you know, she's coming in later than me. And he wakes up in the middle of the night and he thinks he hears her coming up the stairs and then taking off her clothes. And then he realizes, you know, at some point, oh, this is my imagination. And it's poems like that that you feel like you're having a conversation with him. And he's explaining how he feels.
Tell me again the name of the poet.
It's Christopher Reed, and it's A Scattering.
We're talking about books, poetry, and everything literary on All Sides Weekend, and we're watching our pronunciation here on WOSU. We are going to come back in 1.5 minutes, so don't go away. 292-8513.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with songwriter, guitarist, and singer Alex Chilton. He died Wednesday at the age of 59. As a teenager, he recorded the hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby with the Box Tops. Later, he co-founded the band Big Star. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Tune in tonight at 11:30 on WOSU TV for Columbus on the Record. Mike Thompson and his panel will discuss lawmakers from Ohio and healthcare reform, ODOT and passenger rail, and also what movies should be shown in schools. That discussion tonight at 11:30 on Columbus on the Record on WOSU TV. And remember, you can get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40. Sunshine today and a high of 65. Clear skies tonight and a low of 43 degrees. Some sunshine for Saturday, and then a few clouds move in the afternoon, a high of 65 for Saturday. And then rain moves in early Sunday morning, cloudy skies and rain and a high of 58 for Sunday. All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I was just telling a tale, and I'm going to just finish it if you don't mind, because we're going to talk in a moment about the books that you really, you're reading them, they're not doing it for you, and you really have to stop, and how hard it is for some of us to give up, to put a book down. And I am halfway through the brand new, officially sanctioned biography of the Queen Mother, which is 1,100 pages long. It knocked down a wall in the Whetstone Library on the display. And thank goodness for Mrs. Simpson, the Duchess of Windsor, who comes in on page 500 as the Black Devil, and it, all of a sudden it gets interesting then. So anyway, but I am committed to finishing this book. So in a moment, after we talk to a couple of callers about poetry, I want to ask about the books that you really can't bear to finish. But we have a caller from Kevin. Kevin has a poetry recommendation. Go ahead there, Kevin.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. You had just mentioned an Ohio poet, and I have come across a wonderful book by an Ohio poet that I think, you know, is sort of a great reflection of middle American experience, and I thought it was kind of a nice read for this time of year. And it's called The Trouble with a Short Horse in Montana.
Great title.
It is a great title. And it's by Roy Bentley. Uh-huh. And it's published by the White Pine Press, and apparently it won the White Pine Press Poetry Prize. And I just thought that it was a great read, and the poems are fantastic, and I thought that would be a good recommendation. So it's The Trouble with a Short Horse in Montana by Roy Bentley.
Thank you so much, Kevin. We appreciate the call. Thank you. Is Bentley someone that you know?
Yeah, I've read with him a couple times. He's a great guy, and I would agree. He's a quintessential Ohio poet. Most of his poems revolve around Ohio themes, and I would recommend reading his work as well.
And we have Carol on the line, who has a recommendation of two books. Hello, Carol.
Yes, I wanted to recommend The Help, that novel by Katherine Stoughton, which probably everybody's heard of. And then right after it, I read Freedom's Daughters by Lynn Olson, which is a nonfiction account of women in the civil rights movement, many of whom I'd never heard of. And reading them together just really made that time come back alive for me.
Thank you so much for that recommendation. The Help is something that I think we've all raved about, Katherine Stoughton. Mm-hmm. That's finally now number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It's been on the list for 40 weeks, but now it's been number one for a couple of weeks.
And
now
she's on the long list, too, for the Orange Prize, which is the Orange Prize for Fiction, which is a novel by women. The novel has to be written in the English language, and it comes out of London, but it's an international award. So
and we have an email from Ed who wants to talk about recorded books, books on tape, which I know are very popular and very important to a lot of people, and he likes to have them in the car when he's driving. He recommends anything narrated by Jim Dale, who does the Harry Potter series, and he likes David Sedaris and any of Sarah Lowell's as well, reading themselves. So there's a shout-out to recorded books there. Does that replace reading the books to any of you? Is there a difference between listening and reading?
It is for me.
Okay.
I've tried it, and it is a very different experience. And mostly, it's more entertainment for me. I also miss my exits. So I really can't. I have to be careful because I have on long driving trips. And
I've wound up in Pennsylvania a couple of times and not expected to be there very much. Okay, here's a question that that Bill Eichenberger on his blog, thebooksurf.com, has been entertaining us with for a while now. And I think it's a very good topic. These books that we start reading, we know we're not liking them. We have guilt about putting them down. So we've talked about this before, but if you have any specific titles or if any one of you, our three literary stars, can absolve the rest of us from putting books down, I'd appreciate that. How about you, Bill?
Well, the whole conversation I had with Julia Keller at the Chicago Tribune, one of the things I tried to do is I think there's two different kinds of books. There's a book I would like to finish. Someday, hopefully, I will finish it, and that would be like James Joyce's Ulysses or Melville's Moby Dick. I really do hope to finish them, and I've enjoyed reading them. I just cannot get through them. But there are other books like Don DeLillo's Underworld. I got 600 pages in, and I simply lost all desire. And I've never looked over my shoulder and said, boy, I wonder how that ends. I don't care. I really could care less.
But see, 600 pages
in. What an investment. I would finish it just
to
say.
How long was the book?
About 800, 850.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry. You know, I'd get the tape and play the last CD. How about you, Cassie?
I can't think of any titles, at least that come to mind, but for a long time in my life, I did not allow myself to not finish a book.
See,
I was
26.
I'm still there, right.
And I got to the point where I just let it go. And I think it's, you know, sometimes I will start a book and I will get, you know, 100 pages into it and I think, you know what, it was a really good idea, but this is just not the way to spend my time. And there are so many books out there, and it's not to say this one isn't a worthy book. It just isn't for me, and I'll let someone else finish it. And so I have lost the guilt.
Cassie Rose is giving us all absolution, mm-hmm. So that's a good
thing. This may be blasphemy, or maybe it's heresy. I'm not
Watch
sure
your
the difference between
that's
the two.
Okay.
But I 3 pages into The Da Vinci Code, I knew I wasn't going
to
read it.
That's interesting to me now because I'm not going to repeat what you said on your blog. You can say it for yourself.
Yeah.
But talk about – because that's a book that everybody knows. That was a huge cult-following book, et cetera. And Bill Eichenberger on page 3 said, ain't no way. I am not reading this book. Why?
Now, that doesn't surprise me, though. It doesn't surprise me at all. And what comes to mind is I can tell you I didn't finish Twilight, and I probably got 25 pages
into
it.
I think those books are guilty pleasures, too, for a lot of people.
Really. But I could tell immediately he was a consummate hack. And I could tell that – and it's one of those – and I've never quite solved this question, but I do believe that either they're doing it unselfconsciously just because it's the way they think writing should be, but they absolutely go for the cliché.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one in almost every paragraph. And they're like seeking it out. You know, it's not like, you know, because you're taught in writing to avoid cliches, mm-hmm. and stereotypes. And they go just in the opposite, mm-hmm. direction. So I figure at some point it must be purposeful. Like other people are reassured by cliches and, mm-hmm. bad writing. And so therefore that's what you give people.
Well, I think that there are readers out there that do want that. A long time ago, a friend of mine, she loves to read Danielle Steele. And, mm-hmm. she said, I know in every book she's going to talk about that steaming cup of coffee at the table. She says it over and over again. She says, I like it. And I thought, okay. And so she does. She's, mm-hmm. she likes to have the predictability and the comfort, and she is a diehard Danielle Steele fan. And Denise, if you're listening, I finally have talked about Danielle Steele on the show. So there we go.
You don't know how apt it is that I host the snob edition of All Sides. But no, I have to tell you, but I have an author that I said I would never read this because he was so popular and everybody liked him, and I got addicted to John Grisham. He's great. I think he really is. I mean, he grabs me right away.
Yeah, and he's a notch above, I'd say,
Dan Brown.
Yeah.
Most popular. Not most,
yeah.
Good.
And so, I mean, and I'm not saying that the Da Vinci Code doesn't have anything to recommend it, but it just was nothing I was interested in. I mean, there are other books that I just knew. That's the thing, too, is when you have a whole universe of books, then you get, mm-hmm. to pick and choose. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to. I think you're talking about absolution, though. I think that you have to do penance as well, though.
Yes, you do. Yes,
and
yes,
one of the things I did say at the blog was that it's not a good excuse to stop reading a book because it's difficult or it takes a lot of concentration,
right.
or you know, as Toni Morrison told Oprah, my dear, that's called reading.
Yes.
You know, but at the same time, if you finished a difficult book, give yourself a pass on dropping one that you don't care,
okay.
about.
Okay. and John Grisham is great. And we also have an email from Mike who recommends talk about a seminal book. This certainly was one. He was talking about Every Man Dies Alone, the Falada book that we've talked about a lot. And he recommends further William Shirer's, of course, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Beautiful.
Which is an incredible read. Yes. Mm-hmm.
When I finished that in graduate school back in the mid-'80s, it was at that time the longest book I'd – well, if you count the Lord of the Rings. But it was the longest nonfiction book I'd ever read. Probably still is. And it is gripping. It reads just like – well, and it was the Nazis were so thorough at record-keeping – that,
yeah.
it was unprecedented in the history of humankind to have this sort of historical event this well documented. And he dove in and just absolutely
– And he was there for a lot of it as a reporter, and he brought that perspective to it, that immediacy.
And if you want to get to know Shirer before, read his dispatches from Berlin. He was the radio correspondent for the entire 1930s, and he time and again he kept saying, these people mean what they say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wake up. They mean what they say.
Cassandra there. there. Yeah. We have Todd calling in, who has a comment on a book that he has not been able to finish. Hello, Todd.
Hello. I had read his Dark Materials trilogy, The Golden Compass, that was recently made into a film. At one point, one of the characters, and I won't say which one, but in one of the books, you know, one of the characters is killed, and after that point, like, I put that book down and probably didn't touch it for another couple of years. his belt was dealt with so, like, it was so dignified and so tragic that it was almost like I had to mourn the character before I could go back to reread it. And that just really stuck out in my mind because it's the first time I've ever put a book down because of something that had happened in it.
Now, did but then you picked it up again a few years later, is that right?
I did. I went back and I reread the entire series, and knowing what happened, I was able to push on through.
Well, good for you, Todd. Thanks very much for your call. And we have Joe on the line who is talking about Clive Cussler. Hello. Oh, he's not on hold yet. So, okay, we're still talking to Joe. So I'm going to throw it back to Kevin Griffith, our adult in the panel, to talk about a book perhaps that you had to drive yourself to finish or put down without guilt. Putting down without guilt, I think, is the way to...
Well, I think one book that I did that with, I did finish it, but it was The Recognitions by William Gaddis. I don't know if anybody's read that. That's a massive book about art forgery, and every single sentence in there is like eating an entire fruitcake or something. It's just incredibly dense, and, you know, it's... we read that in graduate school, and... a lot of my peers in graduate school said, you know, if you get stuck, just read through as fast as you can. Just whatever you can do. Don't worry about absorbing every little bit of it. Just read it through. And that's how I was able to get through that one. And it was interesting. I had the same feeling with a similar title, The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen. I really liked about the first 120 pages of that. But that got to be a little tiring late in the game, I think. Right. But I did finish it. It was worthy. And I'm glad I did finish it. Yeah. And it's a worthwhile read.
And I have to ask each of you, at what page number did you put down Ulysses? I'm going to say I made it to 50. I've never, in five attempts, have never gotten page 50.
330.
Wow. That's pretty good. Yeah. So basically, you get a pass. You go to heaven for that because you can't finish it. How about you, Cassie?
I don't think that I can give a page number because I studied it in college, and we didn't read it from beginning to end, but I read the ending and that very famous last line of Molly Bloom.
Yeah. Right.
You're not going to believe this, but when I was in graduate school, we actually had a little club, and we read Finnegan's Wake aloud.
Oh,
it took us two years.
Wow.
To read it aloud?
We met every week and read that aloud. Yeah. Don't ask me what it's about. Apparently some guy dies. I don't know.
I was going to ask if in reading it you tried to also understand it. But I think also that Finnegan's Wake, like Gertrude Stein, has to be heard.
Yes.
In a way. It has to be heard rather than just read.
But did you discuss it also after you read it?
Yes, we read it. Oh, we read it aloud, and there was a professor with us who led us through it. Okay. But, yeah, don't ask me of what I remember about
it. And now we have Joe on the line. Hello, Joe. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm a big fan of Clive Cussler. I realize it is way out, far out, but I like to be entertained, and the more action, the better. And if I'm not mistaken, he was the author of Sahara that was made into a television show or a movie. And of all things, it was supposedly a Civil War submarine that ended up in the Sahara Desert.
Okay, that's a little bit of a leap.
Well, now, like I say, he's probably the adult Potter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harry Potter. Okay.
But he also is using some of his money to search for treasure in the ocean. He's come up with several different bells and so on from old ships, and that gets to be quite expensive, but apparently he's got lots of money.
And most of his novels are set undersea or underwater or...
Right, and he's got a hero that probably could eat bullets.
Oh,
you know, he's Superman on Earth. They go up in this Sahara. They go up a river with the guns of blazing, and like I say, it's unbelievable, but yet it is very entertaining, and it's hard to put one of them down. And my next favorite would, of course, be anything that has Sherlock Holmes in it.
Right.
So we're all getting nods of recognition. Thank you so much, Joe, for your recommendation. We appreciate your call. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Christopher Purdy. We're talking about books today on All Sides Weekend. We have 5 minutes yet to go with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. 292-8513 is the number. And Mike is on the line with a trick to getting Ulysses read. So get your pencils ready. Write this down. Hello, Mike. Is this this is involving controlled substances, or is it legal?
I mean, no.
Okay.
Although I've never, I don't know, maybe. no, I was one who could not read Shakespeare as a youngster. I just could not get through the voice. And I learned to read it on long play records while looking at the text.
Yep. Oh, yeah, I did that, yes.
And that was wonderful for me because now Shakespeare is no big deal. Ulysses, there is a recorded book version that is authorized by Joyce's family and institute and all that. And in Ireland, there are clubs. They always read it out loud, and there are people who are famous for reading it. They know what some of those noises mean. And they studied it for a year before they even started recording and went to all these people. And it's an extraordinary book. It must be read out loud. It's like Shakespeare. It's fine on the page, but out loud, it is extraordinary. I still have not sat down to read through it. I don't feel a need to. It's amazing.
Mike, I thank you for your call. We got to run because, as usual with this show, in the last 3 minutes, we have 8 people on hold. I don't know why. Would you please spread out your calls a little more, for goodness sake? But and they're all being called in now. I don't think we're going to have time to get to very many of them, but we do appreciate the people who have been calling here on All Sides Weekend. So we've got a dramatized version of Ulysses to listen to. It was actually made into a movie. I don't know why or how, but it was actually made into a movie. The closest that I got to finishing Ulysses was reading about Sylvia Beach, which was a great, great story. We have Jim on the line who wants to talk a bit about Ken Follett. Hello. Not on hold yet. Okay, so we're still working there. Now he's there. Jim, are you there? Jim?
This is Tim, yeah.
Go ahead. Tim, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a quick story about Ken Follett. I started to read Pillars of the Earth when I was in ninth grade. And couldn't finish it because it was just too violent. I actually told my teacher she should take it off the shelf. But years later, the funny thing is I picked it back up and started to read it. It's one of my absolute favorite books. And so that's just one of the ones I eventually powered through and learned to just kind of get behind all the adult themes in the book, I guess.
That's interesting because I loved his early stuff, and then I kind of fell away from him as he sort of went on. And that was one that I always was curious about.
We have a time for one more call very quickly with Sarah because she wants to ask about American Psycho. I couldn't finish that either. Sarah, are you there?
I am.
Go ahead.
That was the most horrifying book that I've ever tried to read.
Yeah, Brent Easton Ellis, yeah.
Yeah, and the first 10 pages I had to put it down, and it was required reading.
Really?
Wow.
That's
my freshman year of college.
Wow.
So, I didn't do too well.
Should I ask where you went to college?
Kent State.
Okay, well, I mean, I might have an issue with that, but thank you very much for your call. We are running out of time. I thank everybody on hold. I'm sorry we can't get all to your calls. We do this show once a month, so here's the rule of thumb. 10 minutes into the show, start calling. Don't wait to the last 5 minutes. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We've been talking about books today with Bill Eichenberger, a book critic. His blog is thebooksurf.com. Give me
thebooksurf.blogspot.com.
Surf, S-E-R-F.
S-E-R-F.
Like Russian slaves. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic, and her blog is thelongestchapter.com. And Kevin Griffith, poet Kevin Griffith, is professor at Capital University, and he recommends thepoetryfoundation.org. You can get all that information in one place, WOSU.org/allsides. That's all you need to know. And I'm Christopher Purdy. My thanks to Amy Jurek, our producer today, and to Brady O'Callaghan, who manfully mastered the phones for all these calls coming in. And thank you all for calling. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 155 years. 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.